Hello, and welcome to The Musical Activist. I'm Sarah Nichols. I'm a pianist and composer, and I wanted to find out how, as a musician, I can respond to the headline that we've got 12 years to save the planet. So today I am with, on Zoom, as is the norm these days, Dr. Liz Bagshaw, and you are a senior lecturer in Earth and Environmental Sciences at Cardiff University. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So Liz is kindly going to be one of our speakers on the tour, my 12 years tour, which is starting on the 8th of October and finishing on the 25th. Of October, and the Cardiff date is, I believe, the 24th. Is that what you have in your diary? Excellent.
I think so.
Brilliant. So far, so good. And we're being hosted by the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama. Liz, you obviously work in Cardiff. Can you tell us what you do in your job? Can you sort of describe what your area is, perhaps? Let's put it that way.
So I'm a glaciologist, which means I study how glaciers change over time and try and understand the mechanisms that control that change. So I'm really interested in how glacier melt influences downstream systems. So if you have a melting glacier, what's the consequence of that extra meltwater? And my main research speciality is biogeochemistry. So I'm interested in how the chemistry of that meltwater changes over time and what that means for the ecosystems that depend on glacier melt. So some of my research is exploring the microorganisms that live on glaciers and underneath glaciers and trying to understand the chemical changes that they make to the meltwater. And some of my research is in developing new techniques to measure the meltwater underneath the ice and making new technologies that can communicate data back through the ice to find out where the meltwater is and what it's doing. And then the rest of the time I teach undergraduate students in geography.
Excellent. And is that teaching really broad in terms of what you have to cover?
Yeah, I'm lucky in that I get to teach a lot of my favourite research specialisms. So I do a year one chemistry course and I do a year three glaciology course where I get to talk about all my favourite things. And I also get to do a lot of field teaching, which I really enjoy.
So field teaching, actually going out and being on a glacier or in a boat or...?
Well, in a previous world, we used to take our year three students to Switzerland to stand underneath the glacier. There's a really beautiful ice cave at the place that we visit. And so the students can get the experience of being within the ice and see the blue colour and understand the changes. And it's really powerful for them. But obviously, at the moment, we're not taking them to Switzerland, which is really sad, but we're finding ways to adjust and trying to find ways to, you know, bring the environment alive to them in different ways.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because I suppose that's exactly what I'm trying to do. And obviously I'm thinking immediately about track 9, which is Greenland ice melting. And that's a kind of nice place for us to like super connect. And just you started to describe how ice looks to you. Like, can I just let you go on a little bit of a sort of reverie about ice? Because it's lovely for me to think in pictures where obviously I've been thinking so much in sound.
I guess so. The best way to do this is a sort of like my personal ice journey. So the first glacier that I visited was in Switzerland when I was doing my undergraduate degree, and I got the opportunity to do some field work over the summer. I went to help out a PhD student. And just, yeah, hiking up the valley and just kind of seeing it all spread out in front of me. And then, you know, sweating up the ice to go to the place that we were sampling. And just the kind of crunchy noise it makes when you step onto it. It's not quite the squeak of snow. It's something very different, particularly if you have crampons on, so the spikes that you put on your boots to stop you slipping. And that crunch noise and the feel of my feet going into the ice is really evocative for me. So after that first experience in Switzerland, that was the first time I realised that you could actually be paid to be a glaciologist. I was like, oh my God, that's an amazing job. So at that point, I started thinking about doing a PhD for the first time. And then for my PhD, I was lucky enough to go to Antarctica, to the dry valleys in Antarctica. And the ice there is very, very different. It's much, much colder. So that means it's much, much harder. And it's very, very smooth and very, very glassy. And, you know, it almost looks like you can lick it. I mean, you really shouldn't because you'll get your tongue stuck. But that beautiful shine, and because the light there is so different as well, you can see almost, you can imagine all the depths in the ice, all the years and all the little gas bubbles that are trapped in there. And when you step on that kind of ice, you don't get quite the same crunch because the ice is doesn't give way so far. It's more, it's almost a squeak as your crampon points go into it, and you have to work a lot harder to grip on it. And then, yeah, after I think I had five years in Antarctica, and then after that, I started working in Greenland, and the ice there.
Sorry, can I just check? You'd lived in lived in Antarctica for 5 years.
No, no, oh right. God, no, no, I'm not that mad.
I just wanted to check that. So you went there for 5 years.
I came home each winter. So I was there for anything from 4 months to 3 weeks. Okay. each season. But yeah, I'm not quite hardy enough to do a whole winter down there, I think. But yeah, then after that, I started working in Greenland, and the ice there is kind of a mix of the two. You still get these kind of very hard, very cold sections, but you also get the crunchy bits as well that you get on alpine glaciers. And I spent a long time working on one glacier on the edge, which is very crunchy and very crevassed and very lovely to walk around. And then the past couple of years, I've been working right up in the middle where it's all snow covered and you don't really get to see the ice at all. So yeah, I think for me, it's the texture of it, and trying to explain that to someone who's never heard it or touched it is quite difficult. And then the sound that it makes, I mean, you're obviously aware of this, but the popping and cracking noises, and going to sleep hearing all those popping and cracking noises. And, you know, the first night you're sleeping next to this glacier, you hear these noises, and you think, oh my God, we're in so much danger. But actually it's just the ice kind of settling and moving and figuring itself out. And yeah, sometimes you get a really big one and you hop out of your tent and think, oh, but you just get used to it after a while, and it's lovely to hear.
What do you sleep in when you're sleeping on a glacier? Do you say glacier, by the way? Because I haven't really.
I say glacier. Some cool. People say glacier. I don't know what's correct now, to be honest.
Well, I'm going to go with you from now on. So what do you sleep in? Are you like in mega sleeping bags?
Yeah. It's just a regular mountain tent. And then ideally two or three sleeping mats to give you insulation off the ground. And then, yeah, a couple of sleeping bags. Wow. And it's pretty toasty. The worst thing is when your breath condenses and freezes into your sleeping bag. So when you wake up in the morning, you roll over and you get a face full of ice. That's the worst part. But apart from that, it's quite cozy.
I love this. You're really making my brain go to places that I haven't been for ages, like went hiking in, you know, Peru however many years ago, and yeah, I had to sleep. It was, you know, like an altitude trek that I did on my own, and just sleeping in the sleeping bag and that sort of breath thing of altitude. And,
yeah.
But waking up with ice in your sleeping bag, that's quite intense. So, and colours, I just want to ask you about colours, because you mentioned the blue colour. Just, and really early on, I remember when people started going travelling and sort of showing pictures, and like my brother was standing under a glacier somewhere in South America. And it was just like, wow, that's amazing. Like literally being underneath however many meters thick of ice. But can you just tell us about the colours of it?
I think, again, this is something, you know, everyone imagines that beautiful blue colour when you say glacier. And there are many places where you see that beautiful blue colour. And, you know, this place that I'm talking about where we take the students, it's in Switzerland, and they've chainsawed out a tunnel into the ice, so you can go and see that very, very deep blue, and it's just beautiful. But there are, on the surface, it tends to be, you see more white, and then it's only when you look down into a crevasse or down into a moulin, which is one of these big melt holes that transfers the water to the bed, and that's where you start to see the blue colour, the light refraction and this beautiful blue. And it kind of gives you almost vertigo, because you've got not only the depth perception, but the colour change. And the depth perception is very, very hard, because you've got no frame of reference. So you don't know how deep anything
is. A bit like when you're scuba diving and you can't tell sort of which way, like where anything is, if you're scuba diving in the middle of nowhere. Yeah.
Or if you've ever been skiing in a whiteout, and, you know, where the cloud and the ground seem to meet, and you sort of start to feel a little bit dizzy.
Wow.
When you're trying to see where the ground is. And it's that same kind of feeling when you look down, it's like, whoa.
Amazing.
And I think that's where the colours most magical to me, seeing the transition from kind of the white at the top to these blue right down in the depths.
And just thinking about these depths, like what kind of, like, what is the, you know, deepest glacier that you know of? Like, what are the kind of thicknesses of ice that exist in the world?
So Antarctica, up to 4 kilometres.
Deep.
Wow. Yeah. Greenland's up to, does it go up to 3? I think it's about 3. Maybe 3 and a bit, but yeah, about 3 kilometres in Greenland, about 4 kilometres in Antarctica.
So when I was, it's amazing, isn't
no,
it?
No, I was just going to say, like, it is sort of trying to envisage that on a horizontal scale and then flipping it vertically is just, yeah, that it boggles your mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm not an ice core scientist, but I've started working at an ice core camp, because it's a way of getting to the very bottom of the ice sheet.
Mm.
And yeah, that's been really interesting for me, drilling through, you know, 2.5 kilometres of ice. Mm. And then talking to the people who do all the climate archives and look at all the gas bubbles and look at the isotope changes to look at those changes in climate history.
So do you sort of end up with something that looks a bit like your wood-burning funnel, but in ice? Is that sort of roughly what you end up with, like a tube of ice, essentially?
It's a drill about that diameter. It goes down, just spins away, and every 2 metres they pull up a section, bring it up, and then it's measured instantly for a couple of parameters. Then it's cut up into 0.5 metre long sections, labelled, boxed, and shipped home. And there are archives of ice from all over the planet stored in these amazing repositories. And you can go into these ice core repositories, and it's just this huge long room, this freezer, with boxes and boxes of labelled ice cores. And so you can say, right, I want something from 100,000 years ago. And they go, oh yes, box 64.
No way.
That's amazing. that's one of the things that I found really fun in the past couple of years is getting involved in the ice core community, because it's just, yeah, it's mind-boggling.
Incredible.
And then, yeah, but, you know, then you have these amazing repositories, and some of the more interesting ones are from, obviously, the very, very deep ones, because we've got the longest climate records, but the repositories from glaciers that are no longer there. So some of the tropical glaciers, like Kilimanjaro, places like that, there are ice cores from those that are kept in archive. So these kind of last remaining pieces of ice. And yeah, you just have to hope that the freezers don't fail, because there have been instances where freezers have gone and, you know, the whole archive's just a puddle of water then. Yeah. So that's kind of part of the appeal as well, is they're so precious and yet potentially so ephemeral.
It's really fascinating, because in the place where I was having the artist residency in Iceland, it was basically a gallery. It's called the Library of Water. And
wow.
Upstairs, the floor is like volcanic, and then there's basically about 20 tubes of glacial water. And so I'm now thinking, I wonder, did they, you know, is that from a core? Like, did they use a coring thing? Because they look exactly like the sort of core columns that you're talking about. So, but yeah, that, and it was, yeah, and like an amazing place, you know, sort of the view just looking out over the sea on the north coast of Iceland. But yeah, the concept of glaciers from that don't exist anymore being in a library, I mean, that is quite an evocative image. And the other thing that boggled my mind when I was just going to say, when I was writing the music, there was like a 4 mile wide, I guess, iceberg. I don't know what point something goes from a glacier to an iceberg. Actually, maybe you can just quickly tell us that.
So an iceberg is detached from its parent glacier.
Ah, okay. So, it becomes an iceberg as it breaks off.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So when it's attached to the glacier, it's still part of the glacier. But then once it's completely detached, I mean, I'm sure that the iceberg people have a much better definition of, you know, how much needs to be detached. But it's a bit that is entirely floating. So it's not touching, it's not grounded anymore. It's what we call the ice that's sitting on the land. And then once it becomes detached, it becomes an iceberg. There's also an ice shelf, which is a section of ice that is floating, but that is firmly attached to the land ice. So you get icebergs coming off the front of glaciers, and you get them coming off the cross of ice shelves. But they only become the bergs once they've kind of let go.
So when I was writing the piece, a 4 mile wide bit of ice came off a glacier, and I'm pretty sure it was in Greenland. And, you know, it was really shocking to me. I mean, also thinking about the depth. So, I mean, like just the mass of that ice. I don't know if you recall that event, or if that event is horribly normal, or.
I think what sort of struck a chord for me on that one. I think it was from Petermann Glacier, maybe? I can't quite remember. But you're kind of used to seeing that news story from Antarctica. You know, these big icebergs carve off in Antarctica very, very regularly. Yes, they are probably carving more frequently and more ice is going now, but it's a fairly regular thing in Antarctica to see these big bergs go. In Greenland, that's what kind of made me sit up and read that story again, was, oh, right, it's happening up there now. And I think there was something a couple of weeks ago, again, from somewhere up in North Greenland, large section has detached. And yeah, that's what was sort of noteworthy about that story for me, was that, right, this is in my neighborhood now. And some of that is because it's better observed than it has been historically, but some of it's because it's changing much faster.
So since we've got to this point, can you tell us what, you know, what is happening now? What are the changes, and what are you noticing over your sort of years of research?
I think So if we think back to that Swiss glacier that was the very first one I went on, going back to that glacier now, it has retreated such a long way. You know, it's I can't quite remember the exact number, but it's, you know, of the order of a kilometre. Like, I can stand where I did my research and there's no ice there now. And that's in my very short career. Mm. So in the Alps, we're seeing those changes very, very visually. In Greenland and Antarctica, we're seeing, particularly on the Antarctic Peninsula, we've been seeing massive changes for a long time. Where I worked in Antarctica is an area called the Dry Valleys. And that was noteworthy because the glaciers there they move very, very slowly. They respond very, very slowly. So they weren't really changing that much throughout the 90s and early 2000s. But what we're starting to see in the Dry Valleys now is the ecosystems responding. There's a lot more meltwater around than there ever used to be. And that's really changing how the system works. And then in Greenland, we're seeing these big melt years happening more and more frequently. So, for example, in 2012, we had a project when I was working at the University of Bristol, monitoring meltwater coming out of a particular glacier in southwest Greenland. And for a long time, you know, we'd set up our monitoring equipment and you'd know where to put it and you'd know kind of how much water would be coming out. So you'd know where to put it on the banks of the river. And in 2012, the water just kept coming and we were having to move our monitoring station further and further up the bank. And all the records just got blown in 2012 from our recent observational history. And I think those kind of events are becoming more frequent. We're seeing those high melt years. We're seeing days when melting is being experienced across the whole of the Greenland ice sheet, not just around the edge, but right up in the centre. And the place that I work now, which is right up in the middle, we're drilling an ice core through 2.5 kilometres of ice to try and understand how the ice is moving. And it's usually about minus 20 up there. And there have been days where they've experienced surface melt at East Grip. And that's really, really unusual, seeing melt right up in the middle. It doesn't happen for very long, but just a couple of days. And that's enough to kind of really wobble the system.
So that means it's gone up sort of 20 degrees then, does it, if the surface is melting?
Yeah. And it'll just be, you know, the odd day where you have some kind of changing meteorological event. I mean, in the height of summer up at East Grip, surface temperatures can be round about freezing. So it's not a huge day shift in 20 degrees. But it's from the mean temperatures around about minus 20, the air temperature in the summer is anything from minus 20 to about minus 5, and then just having a couple of days around about 0 or 1. I mean, it feels tropical up there. You just you don't know what to do with yourselves. And that's really interesting, seeing evidence of surface melt right up in the centre of the ice sheet.
So, I mean, what are your sort of feelings right now about, you know, when you're experiencing that and seeing that? What do you kind of want to like say to people listening about, you know, why is ice important and what's going on and what can we do, you know, these sorts of areas? I mean, obviously we're going to be able to get into that in the post-show discussion, but just sort of to have your initial, you know, thoughts and feelings on that.
I think the thing is that ice is melting. All the ice on Earth is melting. Some is melting faster than others. And it is almost certain that ice is melting because of response to human activity. And that's what's been interesting in the last few years is, you know, the science has been able to not come to a consensus, because I believe there was a consensus already, but actually say with strong certainty, this is happening because of human activity. You know, we know that there are natural cycles that change the climate over time on Earth. But what is happening now is unprecedented in the climate record. And yes, we have had times on Earth where we've lost the majority of our ice, but in those time periods, the sea level is much, much higher than what we live with today. So if we lose all our ice on Earth, then we lose quite a lot of our land. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's really critical for us to monitor what's going on the ice sheets, is because as the ice melts, that water's got to go somewhere, and it ends up in the oceans. First, it increases the level of the ocean, so we have rising sea level. Also changes the temperature of the ocean, so a huge influx of cold, fresh water can disrupt some of the circulations and have the potential to disrupt some of the kind of weather and climate systems. Then there's the kind of the fact that chemistry of the water has the potential to impact what's going on in the oceans, changing kind of the biogeochemical dynamics of the oceans. And then the final thing is, if you take all that ice away from the land, then the land surface actually kind of springs back up again. So when you're trying to figure out, okay, we've got this much ice and we think it's melting this much each year, therefore, how much is sea level going to rise? It's not quite as simple as it seems. You can't just say, right, this much water equals this much sea level rise, because you have to take into account the way the land is changing, the way that the temperature of the oceans are changing. If you have warmer water, it takes up more space. And so there's quite a few factors that need to be monitored. And that's why it's a really, really hard thing to do. And that's coupled with the fact that observing the ice sheets is really difficult, because it's cold, it's dark for 3 months of the year, and it's very, very hard to get in situ observations. So it's quite a difficult problem. And there's been some really great progress in the past few years on use of satellites to monitor what's happening on the ice. And some of that's been because there's been new satellites launched which actually go over the polar regions, whereas in the past we'd end up with a kind of big unknown in a lot of the places that we were trying to collect observations, because the satellites didn't go where we needed them to. But there's been some really great progress on the satellite record, and there's been some really good progress on the in-situ observations. And so we're getting to the point where we can start to build a much better picture of what's going on, but it's a slightly grim picture, I'm afraid.
Mm. So do you find that there's a tension between what you're learning and what you're able to tell the world through going to, for example, Greenland and studying an ice core, and this kind of tension between individual behaviour change and trying not to fly, or the sort of carbon offsetting, or, you know, what's your take on all of that?
I think it is. It's a very difficult question, and it's one that I wrestle with a lot. As a field scientist, you know, I do my science by going to the field and making observations, and I can't do that without being there. And so I'm having to balance: is this important enough for me to know, to make the choice to make the flight, and then trying to kind of offset my behavior in other ways. So I won't fly for personal holidays. If I'm working anywhere that I can get to by train, I will. So for example, I managed to get out to the Alps for some field work this year, and we got the train there, and it took a long time, and it was kind of a pain hauling all our gear around. Turns out train stations don't have trolleys like airports do, but it was, you know, I felt that I could justify going in a way that if I'd flown, I don't think I could have done. And, you know, this place that we take our students in Switzerland, we've now said we will only go if we can go by train. We don't think that we should be flying our students anywhere, because it's not setting a good example. Whereas if we can say, look, you could still go to these places, but travel in a more sustainable way, then it just puts that seed in their minds, so that rather than trying to book holiday with a cheap flight, they might think, oh, could I do something slightly different? And, you know, we've seen through the pandemic, actually, there has been an improvement in air quality, which is fantastic. And there's been a dip in emissions, but the dip in emissions is not enough. So I think personal responsibility is important, but I think all of us making small changes is not going to make a big enough difference. I think I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. We should absolutely do it, and everyone should consider their responsibility. But we need larger scale action as well. And I think that's what's going to be interesting about the next decade, is how that balance is reached.
Yes, absolutely. I totally agree. So if people want to do any pre-reading, I want to get onto music in a sec, but is there anywhere where you'd recommend people to go, just if they want to kind of gen up on their knowledge of glaciers before they come to the show and speak with you?
Ooh, I'd say, so
we can put references on this as well. Yeah.
I'm just trying to think of there's a nice book called The 2 Mile Time Machine by Richard Alley, who's a professor in the US. It's quite an old book now, so that a lot of progress has been made since it was written. But he talks about the science of ice cores and how you can observe climate history through them, and describes how all that happens.
Great.
If you want something more kind of technical, there's a special report on the ocean and cryosphere in a changing climate, which it was done by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And this is all about, you know, what is happening in the ocean and the cryosphere, so all the frozen sections of land, and trying to summarise all the science on that in a, I mean, it's a mere, let me just have a, I think it's a mere 577 pages. Oh, no, 739 pages. I mean,
so maybe,
but there is a summary at the beginning.
So maybe if you want to know more, come to the show instead. No doubt faster than reading 700 pages of research. Just putting our attention towards the show and to music, you also enjoy music, I gather? Playing, performing, singing, is it?
Yes. So I'm a very, very keen amateur, shall we say. So I've sung for my whole life, and I've played the cello since I was 5. So it's really, yeah, it's a really important part of my life. And that's what's been quite difficult for me during lockdown, is losing that opportunity to make music with people. And in some ways it's been good, because I've started playing the piano again, and I'm pretty hopeless at the piano, but I found that a lot easier to sit down and play 5 minutes of piano, whereas getting my cello out was kind of a magnet for my toddler to come and climb all over me. So I've really missed making music with people. But my choir's just started performing again, which nice. Has been wonderful. I mean, we're doing it through all sorts of restrictions, and it's you know, it's not the same, but just that kind of deep concentration and peace that you get from making music is really nice to have that back. And we're hoping to get orchestra going in a couple of weeks' time, and that'll make my year.
Excellent. And so what did you think when you heard that I'd made a piano recital about climate change? Did you think, she's crazy?
I thought, yay, someone speaks my language. I thought, wow, because I mean, there are many classical musicians in the sciences, obviously, but particularly in glaciology, because if you do a lot of field science, you have to spend quite a lot of time outdoors. So most people's hobbies are, you know, running, climbing, all that kind of stuff. There's a few of us who are classical musicians, but there aren't so many. So it was quite nice to be like, oh, look, someone else who gets it. And so that was what really appealed to me about the project.
Excellent. Well, we're really, really looking forward to chatting with you more after the show for Cardiff on the 24th of October. And we'll post some references with this episode, so people can go and read that report if they want to. But otherwise, do join us and come and ask Liz more questions and see the show. Thank you very, very much for speaking to us today.
Thanks for having me. See you soon.
This is the track about the glacier melting in my show 12 Years, which you can book for now on sounduk.net. There's lots of dates and times to choose from, and you can speak to Liz on the 24th of October, hosted by the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama. And I will be on Zoom, ready to answer questions and discuss, so please join us. Book through sounduk.net. Thank you.